Welcome back to Camera Conversations with your host, Colin Campbell. And today is episode 224 of the podcast. And I'm joined in conversation by Daniel Priestley. Daniel is an entrepreneur, global speaker, and the author of some of the most influential entrepreneurial and business books of the last 15 years. I certainly know I've gained a tremendous amount from his writing. During this episode, we draw on Daniel's experience and success across multiple industries and many of his companies, including Dent Global and ScoreApp. You can expect to learn about Daniel's early entrepreneurial lessons in Australia, losing a $14 million offer, and the importance of having a business mentor. Some of the unique insights that Daniel shares around mindset, around money and cash, the importance of building the right team and network for your business, the future of AI, and whether it's a good time to become an entrepreneur are so formative for who you can become in 2024. This conversation was brilliant, and I know you're going to take away so much on a practical level, and I really encourage you to get a pen and paper or even your notes app open and get ready to take down the five-step method to becoming a key person of influence in 2024, the four ways to assess whether your business idea has legs, and even some of the key sayings that Daniel uses to stay sane in a crazy world. This is the third episode of our Dubai tour and the perfect way for you to get ready for a successful year ahead. So please do make sure you've hit that subscribe button and left a five-star rating if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. Today's podcast is sponsored and supported by my podcast, Masterclass. Yes, starting a podcast is difficult. It's hard to sustain it, but on the other side of that is the ultimate personal brand tool and networking tool for you and your business. And I've shared my almost 4 years of knowledge now in growing this to a top 1% show in a 9-module, 54-video course so you can start, sustain, and scale your podcast. In terms of what we cover, of course, we're going to cover all the things like the nuts and the bolts of software, equipment, and editing. But more importantly, I include my frameworks, my processes, my tools in order for you to approach and secure the biggest and best guests in your niche, how to prepare and research for those, and how to expertly host and manage an episode, and even how to market and distribute it to get the maximum number of eyes and ears on your episode. The link will be in the show notes to get involved in the course, and it is www.mypodcastmasterclass.thinkific.com, or you can just click through to the link in the show notes. Daniel has kindly signed two copies of his book, Scorecard Marketing, and I'm giving away both those copies to one of you listeners. All you need to do is share you listening to the episode on your Instagram story or to your LinkedIn profile and tag myself at call.cambro or at Colin Campbell on LinkedIn and tag Daniel as well. And I'll pick two of you before the start of February to give a copy of this incredibly helpful business book. Now, that's quite enough from me. You're going to dive into this episode with an hour and 18 minutes with myself in Dubai with Mr. Daniel Priestley. Daniel, welcome to the show. And we managed to do it in person here in Dubai.
Pleasure. Yeah, I know. What a coincidence.
I think there's a lot to be said for these in-person ones. I've interviewed so many interesting people remotely, and I would love to interview somebody like yourself remotely as well. But when you're able to align the diaries, we can just get that little bit of flow.
Dubai seems to be attracting everyone at the moment. So it's, it's no coincidence. It's great.
Yeah, and I know we're bemoaning the time difference today when you and I are both just recently arriving, but it's not terrible compared to where we could be. So you can always work from here and still be in touch with the rest.
It's an amazing time zone. Yeah, here you straddle the whole, you know, sort of Asia and Europe. It's great.
Exactly that. And obviously you're here in Dubai doing some incredible things in terms of conferences, but I want to rewind much further than that. And I've heard you describe yourself at 19 years old as a bit of a rebel and a misfit. Doesn't seem to be the fit for what you are now, of course, but what was life like back then?
Well, I went to university. I wanted to be an entrepreneur. And I discovered that all the people at university hadn't actually started businesses, and they were just the people who taught the business academic courses. I got upset about it. I dropped out. And went off and joined a startup, which was great. So that was what I was doing at about 19. I kind of just went straight into that startup world. It was an amazing experience. I worked for a guy called John. I was employee number 3. We had no business or bank account or business name or any of those sorts of things. And within 2 years, we had a team of 60 people in Melbourne with, I think, around $6 million of revenue. So I got that first experience of basically the startup to multi-million revenue straight off the bat.
I've heard you speak really warmly before about some of the lessons that you learned from John in particular. What are some of those that stand out?
So John took me under his wing, and he taught me about marketing and sales. So the big lessons were marketing and sales, but he also did a lot of mindset shifting. So he had me do things like carry cash in my pocket, large amounts of cash regularly. So I had thousands of dollars in my pocket at all times. He wanted me to think of $2,000 as just pocket money. He didn't want me to think about it as a lot of money. He wanted to calibrate my brain as to what was a lot of money.
Does that help from a sales perspective then?
So in a sales perspective, we give off nonverbal signals when we're talking to people. So if you're feeling that money is really scarce, and if you feel a lot of emotional attachment to money, when time comes to quote a price or to ask if someone wants to go ahead, your body feels like you're asking this massive thing of somebody. Now, if you imagine a 19-year-old who thinks $100 is a lot of money, I remember shortly before I worked for John, I had a parking ticket and it was $30 or $40. And I had a massive blowout with a friend because he wouldn't split it with me. And we were both driving together at the time, and he refused to split it. And I thought we should split it. He thought I should pay for it. And we had this massive, massive blowout over $20, right? So, you know, I'd gone from that. Now, the people I was selling to, for them, thousands of dollars was just budget that they had available. But my emotional reaction to thousands of dollars gave off nonverbal signals that I was asking them for.
You're carrying that emotion of, wow, if I win this deal, we've all heard of sales breath before. You maybe get it in a car showroom, you go in and you can feel the desperation.
Yeah.
And when they land the price of, it's going to be $17,000 for this Golf or $25,000 for this Audi, you can hear them saying that as if that's a tremendous amount of money, whereas the buyer should be comfortable with that in its entirety.
Yeah, and people pick up on nonverbal communication. We pick up on the idea that, this person thinks it's overpriced. And we kind of just pick up on that. So John recalibrated me around that. He also got me to keep a journal and journal my thoughts and journal what came up. So I did a lot of journaling for the first time. He got me to stop watching the news, completely put a ban on any form of news, radio or TV or any of that. There wasn't social media at the time. Blanket ban on the news.
What do you think was the biggest benefit of that?
Well, it's very much in line with sort of the Stoic principle of only paying attention to the things that you can control. I remember him saying that, once something is on the news, it's too late. And most of what's on the news is just statistically improbable things. So if a plane lands safely, it doesn't make the news. If it has a wobble on landing, it does make the news.
By its nature, it's an outlier.
Yeah, exactly. So he said, these are things that either A, it's too late, or B, it's statistically irrelevant. Either way, it's really not your business. So focus on your business, build your business first. And then if you've got spare capacity later on in life, start, widening the scope of the things that you can influence.
Yeah, I think one of the lessons that I learned from you when you speak about your time in that initial startup was how important those initial lessons were for when you were going to go out yourself, almost an apprenticeship as an entrepreneur.
It felt exactly like an apprenticeship. And I think it's, for anyone who wants to go out on their own, I think that entrepreneurial apprenticeship is of huge value.
Yeah. What beyond those kind of quirky lessons and maybe less regular things?
Well, in very tangible ways, I did a lot of sales. So I would do back-to-back sales meetings for weeks on end. And I mean 10 scheduled appointments in a day regularly. So I was, sort of seeing 60, 70 people in a week. So I had someone setting appointments for me. Okay. And I was sitting in one-to-one meetings and just doing back-to-back sales meetings. So that, as you would know, is an incredible experience around human psychology and communication skills and presentation. Value proposition. I think sales is an incredibly important skill, and it blows my mind that no MBA courses ever teach sales. There's no sales module in an MBA course, which kind of for me is imagine a motoring course, a course on motor engineering, and they don't talk about how pistons fire. They just say, oh, there's an engine. To me, a business is made up of sales moments. And, that is the business. And if you were to zoom into an engine of a car, you're going to see an actual piston firing, and there's a bit of fuel and a bit of a spark, and then bang, it fires. And if you don't understand that fundamental nature of what fuels it, what sparks it, what fires it off, you can't really understand the engine. And if you don't understand what happens in a sales meeting, how customers think, You know, everything kind of extrapolates out from there. I get it that there are mergers and acquisitions and funding and all these kind of things, but I really think every CEO should understand how a sale is made.
Yeah, I do think from businesses that I've worked with, and it is quite common to see the MD coming from a sales background, though, particularly when I worked in the insurance sector, all the senior people had started out as development executives, and they actually had a lot of respect for what I was doing because they knew that you were delivering the lifeblood to the business, which isn't the case in all businesses, as you well know.
As you go bigger and bigger, you see less and less salespeople. So the publicly listed companies typically have CFOs and COOs who end up in the top jobs, but most of the sales and marketing people stay at the lower levels. But I think, you know, even if you do make it to those higher levels and you're not doing any sales anymore, I think it's so important to understand customers and how they think and how they make decisions and all of that sort of stuff.
One of our mutual connections is Spencer Lodge, who has been on my podcast, and I'm sure you've been on Spencer's show as well.
I saw him last night.
Really fantastic, but really, really great guy. And one of the lessons that he taught to the listeners that really registered was when he first started his sales career, he was seeking 200 no's a day. And eventually he just had to kind of tip the balance towards slightly more yeses. But even when he was successful, as a percentage, he was still facing more rejection than he was getting acceptance. And I think a lot of people who, and we'll go on to talk about entrepreneurship and maybe people going out themselves, they almost don't realize that even when you are successful, there's still a higher percentage of people potentially saying no to you than there are saying yes.
I would say it even gets worse as you get more successful. So if you think about an Apple retail store, something like 98% of people who walk in and have a look at the Apple products walk out without spending any money. You know, if you take a big brand like Rolex, I would say 99.9% of people who are aware of the Rolex brand and have seen a Rolex product have not bought one. You know, so it's actually, you know, it turns into tiny, tiny, tiny percentages of people who say yes relative to the size of the business. So when you're starting a brand new business, you might talk to 100 people and get 3 people who say yes. A 3% conversion on brand awareness to conversion would be astronomical for a big brand.
You know, of course, because they've got so much brand awareness, as you say, as a percentage. That's so, so interesting. Given that you had this entrepreneurial apprenticeship, you dropped out of university saying that you wanted to be an entrepreneur. Was there anything that was pointing to that throughout your earlier years that would have indicated that?
I knew straight away. I ran a garage sale when I was 10 years old and I was selling stuff out of garage sale, and I ended up running 3 or 4 of them, and I just loved the idea of putting together a mini business idea. I sold flowers door to door on Valentine's Day, so I wrapped 400 roses up in things and took them door to door dressed in a little tuxedo. I worked at McDonald's, but I worked at McDonald's because I'd read a book called The E-Myth, and it was around the same time. I don't know which came first, but basically I saw it as a stepping stone to being an entrepreneur, that I could discover how these businesses systemize and run.
Well, the franchise at the end of the day, and so the owner is probably some form of entrepreneur.
I met my franchisee, a guy called Randy, who gave amazing advice and talked about, and he actually was very open. He said, look, you don't see me very often, do you? And I said, no. And he said, well, that's because I don't need to be here. This system is so strong that a bunch of 15-year-olds can run a multi-million-dollar restaurant.
It's wild, isn't it? I find that fascinating. And I guess one of my questions off the back of that is, given that you were growing up and you knew you wanted to be an entrepreneur and how much exposure you have through things like your accelerator program, how many people do you think are born to be entrepreneurs and how many can be developed?
Well, it's a bit of a nuanced question, because there's a founder who is going to be someone who starts with a blank page and identifies an opportunity and gets it off the ground. And these founders, myself included, get way too much credit and get way too much fanfare. The majority of the wealth in business is actually made in scaling a business. So if you can take a business from 2 million to 20 million, you're going to make a lot more money than 0 to 2 million. But the 0 to 2 million is what gets all the fanfare. So and arguably, who's the entrepreneur, right? The entrepreneur is anyone who identifies an opportunity, takes a risk, accesses resources beyond their control, you know, and puts themselves on the line to scale something or grow something and do something, you know, that's commercially successful. I really do think that entrepreneurship is a team sport, and a lot of the conversations about founders kind of overlook the idea that it is ultimately a team sport. There might be a moment, like a few weeks or maybe months, where an entrepreneur is acting alone to identify an opportunity. But if you take most of the great businesses and great business leaders and entrepreneurs, very rapidly they've got a team. And there's actually a dynamic that forms in the early days that is more powerful than anything else. And the dynamic is normally between someone who's quite visionary and sales orientated and someone who's very operational and technical. Mm. And those two people are keeping each other in an orbit that is very commercially successful. Now, you'll always hear about the person like me. So ScoreApp, for example, is one of my companies, very successful tech company. We just won Scale Up of the Year at the Great British Entrepreneur Awards. We're growing 10% month on month. We're worth tens of millions on valuation, all those sorts of things. I get all the credit unfairly. The brains of the operation is Steve. Steve is our CTO. He's our smart operator. He builds the product. He builds the scalability. He builds the technology. I run around talking about it. Now, I'm a visionary with Steve, and I kind of like push things out there and push the envelope. But no Steve, no business, right? So Dan and Steve come as a pair.
It's a combination.
Yeah. So if you look at me, you would think that a classic entrepreneur is outspoken and running around making sales and doing all those things, opening up channels, doing partnerships. But I can only do that because I've got an amazing Steve in the background.
That's a really important piece of self-awareness though as well, because many founders or entrepreneurs could kind of drink the Kool-Aid to some extent, couldn't they? And kind of buy into the hype and become tyrannical or disregard the importance of somebody that's operational or really technically focused.
Exactly. Steve's great because he respects my strengths. I respect his strengths. It's the dynamic between us. The funny thing is if you cut Steve off from me, he tends to get lost in the weeds. He tends to spend too much time in the detail. If you cut me away from Steve, I just tend to talk my mouth off and nothing happens. So it's the dynamic. We need each other.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Are you familiar with the DISC personality model? There's so many different types. But I hosted Thomas Erickson on the show, who's the author of Surrounded by Idiots, mm-hmm. which is based on that kind of Carl Jung model. Types, yeah. And he was speaking that traditionally when they do that testing, Insights Discovery is one of the main companies that does it in different businesses, they find that a lot of senior management are more red-blue, which is dominant, outspoken, like quite hierarchical mm-hmm. and quite forceful. And the blue is like the kind of analytical side. So mm-hmm. the kind of perfect CEO they deem is something like red, blue, mm-hmm. but more people tend to be red, which is like, get shit done, let's go, mm-hmm. outspoken, extroverted. But a lot of people that work in operations, stock, planning, all these different areas that kind of make the boat go faster or function whatsoever, come from a very much more introverted background, and they're much more focused on like the nuts and the bolts. And it's really interesting that you're speaking in these terms, and what he's saying is almost coming to fruition in terms of the balance and partnership that you've found for ScoreApp.
Yeah. And as you get bigger, you end up with a senior leadership team of five, and you have a really good balance. So you've got the CEO, who's the visionary, the COO, who's like a task oriented person, CFO, who's very analytical, CMO, who's kind of probably a bit more creative, CTO, who's analytical and creative. So you're going to have this balance of people around you. And what you're looking for is this chemistry, this dynamic that you're actually all bringing a strength to the table and covering a weakness. And that's a perfect senior leadership team.
Yeah. Post working with John then, you went out yourself. Mm-hmm. How did you build your senior leadership team and your team then?
Yeah, so when I launched a business at 21, I actually launched on day one with a few friends. So I was the founder and, you know, I started with the equity, but I brought very rapidly someone who played the CMO or CRO role. And I also had a general manager, or I kind of referred to him at the time as a Swiss Army knife. He could do anything badly. and I meant that in like with a lot of love, right? That he wasn't particularly technical at anything, but he could figure anything out to a basic degree. And, you know, whatever needed doing, he could figure out a way of getting it done. May not have been the best way in the world, but he got it done. So a Swiss Army knife and a really good salesperson. So I started the business and we took off really fast. We got to 1.3 million in year one, 400,000 of profit. Year three was 10.7 million. So it was very fast growth.
And that was an events business, wasn't it?
Yeah, so you could think of us as a performance marketing agency specializing in introduction events.
Okay.
So what we'd do is partner with a company that already had a product or service that was established but had stalled, hit a plateau, and we strapped a very particular type of marketing on the front end, and we got paid per result. So we would basically focus on these introduction events, and that was our skill, running intros.
Yeah, but it's fascinating to hear you, and obviously when we look back in hindsight, it's easier to do, but identifying the different people that you brought with you on that journey in the early stages and look at the success of that business in that regard.
Yeah, yeah, we had that dynamic. The dynamic was really strong. Yeah.
Yeah. What led to you then upping sticks and moving to London?
So it was a very strange time. I had an opportunity to sell the company for a lot of money, and then in the negotiations, all communication broke down. We all threw tantrums and the whole thing fell apart. So I was 24 years old. I was about to sell my company for 14 million. And basically it ended up in a lawsuit between the two companies and we ended up settling it and all this sort of stuff. But it was a real roller coaster because essentially you can imagine what it would feel like at 24 that we're about to, you know, have a big chunk of change. And then all of a sudden it just all falls
like apart. Snatched away from you almost.
I wouldn't say snatched away because I threw my tantrums as well.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
I like that level of ownership.
Yeah. I played my role, full responsibility. Anyway, but the net result was that I had a clean slate. So I had a moment in time where I had a clean break and I could restart our business with new partners in Australia. But I got talking to a mentor of mine, who said to me, if you're going to restart, he said, why don't you do the UK? He said, it's three times the population. You get the opportunity to, you know, travel around Europe, something a bit different. Wouldn't it be nice to, you know, if you're going to restart, why not start in a bigger market? Also, the pound was 3-1 on the dollar at the time. So he said, also, if you earn pounds and want to come back to Australia, you triple your money on the way back. So all of that made sense. And I went, actually, the skills that I've got are transferable. I'm going to go and...
I think that's a really important thing. Like everything you've learned up until this point is applicable in many different arenas. And that's something that I really like about sales from my perspective. You can apply it in so many different domains. Like to book in with you as a guest, there was a sales transaction for me to do with a mutual connection of ours, then your PA, and then we ended up here. It's applicable in so many different domains, but people don't always consider that.
Oh, sales is a life skill. Everyone should do sales at some point, yeah.
And we should make an MBA for it.
We should put it in every MBA course. Yeah, it's crazy that it's not.
Yeah, it's absolutely wild. But you arrived in London with a fresh slate, and I think you've described it before as with a credit card in a suitcase.
Well, that was the challenge I set myself. Having built a big business in the past, I had quite a big credit card limit. So I had about a $70,000 credit card limit on my Aussie card. It's pretty astronomical for a 24-year-old, 24, 25 at that point. So I set myself this challenge that I'm going to turn up, start from scratch. Because, that was the other thing. My business coach had asked me what I love about business. And I said, starting, right? And I like the constraints. And he said, well, start with a suitcase and a credit card and see if you can launch a business.
Challenge accepted then.
Yeah, challenge accepted. Yeah. So I rock up in London with a suitcase and a $70,000 credit card, which translates to about £25,000, maybe £30,000, something like that. It was my starting capital. And in year one, we ended up making about £4 million worth of sales. It was pretty wild. So from standing start, knowing nobody in London, at the end of year one, we ran a 2,000 seat event in the London Palladium Theatre, multi-speaker full day event. And we made off the back of that event, something like £600,000
in one week
off the week.
That's incredible. Yeah. What did you do right in that 12 month period?
So the way that I launched was really fun. So the first thing I did is I rented a private dining room, 25 people, 30 people, right? Something like that. And what I did is I reached out to all the most influential people that I could find the name of. And I said, hey, I'm arriving in London. I'm building a business. I'm launching a business. I'd love to invite you to dinner. And I'm choosing influential people to come and have dinner. So I basically put together, out of nowhere, I put together 28 people, I think, turned up to this thing. And on the evening, I stood up and I said, I'm going to be launching a business. Here's what we do. I'd love to have a one-to-one coffee with each of you. I've got a membership at a private members club. If you'd be happy to meet with me, I'll walk around with my diary. So I booked all these appointments in. And essentially, in the one-to-ones, I proposed that we do a joint venture and partnership to promote launch events. So out of 28, I think 20 of them partnered with me. And we had, when we pushed the button on the launch event, had 800 bookings in the first hour, and I think a couple of thousand bookings. And I basically did a Manchester, Birmingham, Milton Keynes, London launch. Essentially, we launched with hundreds and hundreds of people coming to our events, and basically kicked off really well.
Yeah, it's fascinating that you chose people who were influential in their field based on what you've gone on to write about, and this would have been well before 2009, wouldn't it? So your understanding of how important somebody with influence, and of course the joint venture side of things, was, it's funny how these lessons were things that you've gone on to tell in the future.
Yeah, it was all experiential. You know, in any town or city, there are people who are the key people of influence. You're either in their circle or you're not. And if you're not, it's hard. And if you are, it's easy. You know, they've already done the last 10 years worth of marathon running. So you want to be able to jump straight to the last post of the marathon
and join in with them. Yeah, they hand you the baton, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I find that fascinating. And I just wonder, like, if you'd taken a different approach to building that business, you would be very unlikely to have achieved 4 million by the end of year one.
Nearly impossible, yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating. How did things transpire from there? Because obviously I've just mentioned Key Person of Influence, one of my favorite books that you've written, and one of my favorite books overall in terms of me understanding what's going on there. But all these lessons that you share within that, when did you start to learn some of those other ones?
The next big learning experience was when within two years, we'd built a really successful business. We were bringing in a big speaker from the USA who had a whole product ecosystem, and we were representing them in the UK. And then we were doing the same with another speaker in Asia. And we specialized in that business in speakers, authors who had products and services to sell. And then 2008, 2009 was the global financial crisis and crash. And we basically had a situation where both speakers ended working with us. So the US guy, we had an issue that the US to British pound currency conversion massively shifted and made it non-viable to bring him back to the UK. It was too expensive and the margins just weren't there. And then the Asian speaker, he almost went bankrupt and basically focused on his core business. So I went from having two really hot products and really good partnerships.
They could sell at events and their products were excellent, so they converted.
Yeah, so we had this really good, everything was like going along really nicely. And then suddenly it was just like, boom, the wheels fell off. So we went from millions and millions of revenue to just collecting outstanding invoices. Basically, and I had an entire team. Like at this point, I think we might have had 15 people on the team, maybe more. So I had to fire everyone. I remember one Christmas party. We had this Christmas party with like 30 people because it was like everyone plus one, and had an amazing time. And then the following Christmas party was three of us. So three or four of us sitting around a table. It was devastating. It was a very... It was a very downward trajectory.
How does that rank alongside the experience of having to start again in London post maybe seeing that £14 million?
Yeah. It seems like I had a bit of a lesson to learn, right? So I was boom busting.
Peaks and troughs.
Yeah, I would say boom busting, right? It was okay. Like, let's call it extreme, right? Because it was what was happening for me was extreme upswing within 2 years. We're doing millions, you know. For perspective, 75% of all businesses in the UK don't even make the VAT threshold or hire a person. So, you know, and that's businesses that have been around for 10 years. You know, so for us to just burst on the scene with no funding, No VCs, none of that sort of stuff, and just boom, you know, we're up doing millions. So I was really good at booming, but I wasn't very good at sustaining it. Right, two boom and then savage bust.
What was your relationship like with money at that point? You'd worked hard on it with the £1,000 or $2,000 in the pocket.
I had a easy come, easy go. Mm. So I was just money came to me very easily, but it also went easily. So very much a flow, free flowing.
Some of my connections that have made like insane money over the last few years through maybe things like crypto or like scaling an online business or an education platform really, really quickly, their relationship with spending to start with was like absolutely wild. I can only imagine when it's boom and bust that it has some sort of impact as well.
Yeah, post the second bust, I ended up moving from a penthouse apartment to my sister's spare room. And I had to really rein in like how I spent and how like money became much more real to me during those period of time. And the UK economy just didn't turn around for another 3 or 4 years. So it was like not until 2012 Olympics that things actually started to tick up in the right direction.
It's funny how events can be a big turning point for these things as well, isn't it? Like when you consider that we had the narrative of austerity for such a long time during 2010, 2011.
Oh yeah, it kept going on and on. But the Olympics was kind of like that uplift, that
catalyst.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was just brought everyone's mood back.
But during that troubling period, you were writing Key Press of Influence, weren't you? 2009, it came out, the first version.
2010 it came out, 2009 okay. I wrote it. So that was a period of reflection. So I was just so busy doing business that I didn't have really much time to reflect. So it was when things had gone wrong that I had to sit down and think, well, what do I know? Like, what do I wish I knew? One of the things that I kind of thought about was, I keep making everyone else famous. Why am I not, you know, capturing that brand equity myself? What do I know about how to do this? What are all of my speakers have in common? What are all of my...
What about all these people that you collaborated with in events? What do they have in common? They're influential.
Yeah. So I did the 5 P's. They're all good at pitching. They're all published authors. They all have product ecosystems around them. They all have a great profile when you Google them, and they all are easy to partner with. They know how to partner. So I just kind of went, that's my model.
The way my brain works, I love alliteration. So when I was reading your book and it was 5 P's, I was like, oh, brilliant. This is so much easier for me to stick with. But that kind of pitch thing, I feel a lot of people need to consider if, and again, we were speaking before we hit record about some of the things that the audience would really value. And a lot of people maybe talking about yourself and like being really effusive about a concept or who you are can be a little bit of a daunting experience. What would be your recommendations for people in that space?
You've got to get good at this. Here's the thing. You're going to introduce yourself 1,000 times every few years. You're either going to do it in a way that pigeonholes you as an average mediocre person, or you're going to do it in a way that's memorable. You are going to introduce yourself thousands of times. So given that that is an opportunity to change your life every single time, I'll give you an example. One of my clients used to introduce herself as, I'm a financial planner. I've been in financial planning for 25 years. And then she changed to, I'm a financial planner. I work with rural families who own big farms, and I help them to pass those farms forward 2 generations, right? We do a plan to make sure that that family farm stays in the family for 2 generations. And just introducing herself in that different way, complete transformation as to, oh, we should get you on a podcast. We should get you speaking at a conference. You should write a book on that. I know someone who's got a massive farm. I know someone who's got a farm. I know someone who's got a farm in Brazil. I know someone who's got a farm in California, right? So it went, you know, like it went from opportunity is hard to opportunities everywhere.
Abundant.
Yeah, just in changing the way.
Yeah, how we frame things and how we talk about things is so, so important. And one of my favorite sales concepts is afters, which is a concept taught by a gentleman called Andy Bounds. And when I interviewed him for the show, it was a bit of a kind of full circle moment, because I got some of his training when I was working in a role in the insurance sector. And the way you explained that there, the generation passes down 2 generations this farm, that's an after of when you deal with me as a financial planner, you can secure the future of your family for future generations. People can picture not who you are and what you do. So a financial planner, 25 years experience. Instead, they picture what it means to them and their future, which is far more important to them than who you are and, oh, I've worked in this industry for 25 years. Okay, so what?
Yeah. So here's like a fun one that I heard with insurance. I help multimillionaires to go skiing and skydiving without their wives worrying.
Really good. Really good. Because that's a concern for them. They're worried that they'll get injured or their wife will be worried that they would be in trouble. It's great. It's just so illustrative. So the first P was around pitching and the second was around...
Publishing.
Yeah. So I find it interesting because you wrote that book and released it in 2010.
Yeah.
The world has changed since then to some extent. How important is it still to have a published book?
Well, for starters, publish just means to make public, to put something in the public domain. So it's normally associated with putting something that you've put thought into, like key ideas, to make your ideas public. So publishing today can be very rapid. It can be putting blogs on Instagram, on LinkedIn, or
Substack,
videos, and you can publish a podcast, you can publish videos. There is something about a book that's very authoritative. So if if you look at the word author, it's authority. So you authored it. You were the one who were the author of the thing, and therefore you're the authority. So there's something very much ingrained in that. I don't think people should write a book early on because it's a slow strategy. It's not the lighter fluid that gets things going. It's the hot coals that keeps things hot. So if you've got a business that's doing a few hundred thousand, then consider writing a book at that point. It's a great way to scale what's working. I think of a book as actually a first meeting. I used to have a lot of first meetings with people. A first meeting is a meeting where you don't really intend to do business. You're just having a, seeing if there's any overlap. And it's a get to know you, right? So in networking, you might go networking, you might have a first meeting, and then you might do business later on. I find the book is just networking and first meeting all done for you at scale. So that's what I'm doing. In fact, the way I do books is I give them away. So when I launched Scorecard Marketing, this one, we immediately printed 10,000 copies, sponsored a bunch of events, and put them in goodie bags at events. And
oh, so it got it in front of your...
I just put it out there. So I just gave away 10,000 copies. So I wasn't at all interested in selling them. I was just interested in getting them onto, at conferences and events where my market is, everyone gets a copy. So essentially I'm having a first meeting. I'm networking with all those people. And the net result was that I think it probably translated into something like 50,000 a month. So it probably cost 40 or 50,000 to do that strategy. And then it resulted in 40 or 50,000 a month worth of recurring revenue.
People that arrived and stayed with you?
Yeah, well, when people read the book, they understand a strategy. They understand what the thinking is. They then say, I want to implement that. And then they become a great client.
Yeah, that's a really, really great point. I find it interesting that you said that it's maybe not the immediate thing to do when you're starting to scale. I would say things like podcasts, YouTube, are probably a lot quicker because they're much more easily to distribute than a book, and there's less of a sunk cost potentially than producing a book that you can't sell or maybe can't even give away at that point because it's not credible enough.
The other thing too is, as you would know from sales meetings, the longer you've been in sales, you develop a repertoire and you come up with these stories that work and you come up with facts and data that works. So you might be having a sales meeting and you say, did you know that 17% of people do this? And they go, really? Is it that high? And that is a hook. And then when you write a book, that goes in. Or you say, actually, I've got this really funny story about a giraffe and a lion and blah, 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 blah. And they go, oh, that's hilarious. Now I get it. And you go, oh, I'm being the giraffe. I should be the lion. And you put the giraffe and lion story in. And it's like, so you capture the best bits of your sales repertoire and you stick it in the book.
Yeah, and the hooks is a vital part of it, as you say, because it's gathering the interest as well. I see a lot of people building almost what is going to become a book through their email list or the Substack now. I mentioned to you when we were getting arranged for this, or I mentioned to Susie, shout out to Susie, that I'd hosted Chris Williamson on the podcast, and his 3-minute Monday newsletter will almost certainly
become
be distilled down into a book. And when I've spoken to him about that, he's like, yeah, it's completely obvious. I'll just expand out on these examples. And how many books are really well-written blogs expanded out over many examples to help you understand it across 150, 200 pages?
Yeah, well, a lot of the KPI chapters were originally blogs, yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So I think that publishing piece is really, really valuable, because to become a key person of influence, you must have information out there that validates your authority as an individual in your space.
At the very basic level, you've got today, you must be Googleable. You've got to be Googleable. Now, even if you're not widely known with millions of people or thousands of people knowing who you are, at the very, very least, if somebody Googles you, you've got to look good. You've got to look credible. So, you know, that you are totally in control of. And it's not a matter of like the algorithm has to favor you or anything. It's like, no, you know, the way you present yourself online should look good.
Yeah, like that press piece is probably quite important there. So being featured in articles by people within your industry.
Even having a nice clean LinkedIn with at least 10 good articles on there and a current article, which means it's less than 2 months old. And making sure that things like your Instagram are nice and clean and represent you the way you want to be represented. If you think about your best contacts in your phone, if they were to have a look through your entire Twitter or your Instagram or any of that, if you cringe at the thought of them looking through your social media, then you go, okay, well, clean
I'm
that
doing
up.
This wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great filter and framework sometimes for these things. Would I be embarrassed if people who I value their opinion or value their judgment,
yeah,
would I be disappointed?
Exactly. Yeah, you want to clean that up.
Vital. So yeah, that's like almost three of the P's, but around signature products, I find that interesting as well. These all obviously have to relate to the niche that you're starting to build out for yourself.
You need to get away from selling time for money. You need to get away from packages, time for money, day rates, hourly rates, all of that sort of stuff. And ideally you want to move towards packages. You want to move towards value-based products and services. And ideally you want people to buy stuff that's not you. So, you know, what's nice about software, like I'm in the software business.
Score App's not called Daniel Priestley App.
Exactly, yeah. So I can roam around having adventures and talking about stuff. And eventually people go along to Score App and they love the software and they love the product and it does great things for them. But that isn't my time. Like if 10,000 people wanted to sign up to Score App today, that's fine. They just sign up for it.
It's ready and waiting to do that. It's scalable. It's not book an hour slot with Daniel or one of Daniel's team. It's not even...
Exactly. It's just username, password, have a free account. If you like it, pay the appropriate subscription after you've tested it and away you go.
Yeah, it's fascinating. We mentioned earlier that when you came to London, you had this private dinner and you started to partner with different individuals of influence in that sphere. And obviously that kind of overlaps to the areas that you're so well versed on now. But those partnerships, what can people consider when it comes to those? Like what does a good partnership look like?
I'll tell you, there's two good partnerships that everyone should consider. One is just called a squad. A squad is where you get 5 to 10 people who all have a similar outcome or goal, and you work together and support each other to get that goal. So let's say you all want to be on podcasts. You create a podcast squad and you basically say, we're all going to reach out. And when anyone invites us on a podcast, we recommend the others to go on the podcast too.
That's really common amongst guests that I've had and amongst hosts. Three or four hosts that I share guests with if they're a good fit for the other person's show, because everyone's show is slightly different. But and it's been a great way for
everyone
the show
to elevate.
And it also validates... When I introduce you to, for argument's sake, you've been on Darren Lee's Kickoff Sessions podcast. We've shared a lot of guests together and it validates immediately, because if you've enjoyed that interview, you're more likely to enjoy mine, and Darren or I will say, and we'll produce good quality clips off the back of it for your shorts. We'll produce the files, whatever you need. You'll have a thumbnail image for your LinkedIn,
and
whatever
wins.
It is. Exactly. And it saves so much time and energy, both for a guest who wants to reach a new audience or talk about a new topic, and for the host who gets lost in the DMs or get lost in the emails quite easily.
Yeah. So also works really well with LinkedIn, like liking and commenting on each other's posts or resharing or amplifying.
An engagement pod.
Engagement pods, yeah. So I call them like a squad, because like if you think about like... the Air Force, they have a squadron of planes that will fly. They don't bang into each other, so they don't overlap. You know, you're not doing this with someone who you're competitive with. You're doing this with someone who you can easily, everyone can succeed, and that's fine.
You want to have people that have an abundance mindset as well, because
abundance
if people
mindset,
within that...
But also practicality. You don't want to do someone who does exactly what you do, right? So it's not someone who's exactly the comparison.
Wants to cut your grass.
Yeah, it's, you know, you might have a relationship coach with a health coach, with a business coach. and they're all kind of like recommending each other. There's a bit of an overlap, but actually it's quite complementary. So the squads are one, and then an advanced partnership is what I call a brand product distribution partnership. So brand product distribution, if you imagine a triangle, think about Nike. They sit in the middle of the triangle and they say, we're going to build our tennis brand with Serena Williams because she's got a big brand in tennis.
Key person of influence.
We're going to expand our product range with Fruit of the Loom because they can manufacture the clothing range. And we're going to have a distribution partner with Walmart, and we'll do a special partnership with Walmart to have a special range just for Walmart. So the Serena Williams branded apparel exclusive to Walmart. So this is the triangle of the three things, the brand product distribution. If we think about Nespresso in the UK, did a big deal with George Clooney and Selfridges and Megamix. So they had the actual Nespresso unit made by Megamix. They had George Clooney as the face of the brand, and they had Selfridges as the exclusive retail distribution point. So that was a brand product distribution partnership. Now, you can see those in the big end of town, but actually they happen all the time in the small end of town as well. So someone who's got a product with someone who's got a brand with someone who's got an email list.
Well, I was going to say, I've certainly collabed with other creators on their email lists with either their products or a product that I've recently launched as well. And it's been really helpful to do that. And equally, if my product's the podcast, if they distribute it for me as well, that's massive too.
Perfect.
Yeah, really interesting. So many of the concepts you bring up, I'm just like, okay, that's great. Some of those I've done to an extent, but some of them I need to turn up. And there'll be people listening to this that are thinking, I've dabbled with this, but maybe I've not maximized the potential of it.
Yeah,
which is so exciting. I was laughing when I was doing my research for this, that, and I didn't know this because you didn't say this in the book, but much of what came to be the entrepreneurship revolution was actually initially planned to be part of Key Person of Influence. Was like your first like 8,000 words or something like that,
yeah,
became that other book. Why did you separate the two out?
When I was writing, I had all of these thoughts around the times that we're in, that we're going through unique times, that it's a big shift, that it's the industrial age turning into something else, that rather than working for a factory or a, you know, an office, you can now start your own business. So that was the lead in, and then it started going naturally into become a key person of influence. And I just couldn't, like, it basically, when I was reading it back through, I was feeling like, God, it's either A, that big concept isn't going far enough, or B, it's taking too long to get into this book. So I just went, chop, we're just going to do a book called Key Person of Influence. So then that was a hit. And then a publisher said to me, hey, what do you want to do as your next book? Do you want a big publishing deal? I said, yeah, sure, I'll do another book. And they said, have you got any concepts? And I said, well, I've got these 8,000 words that we chopped off. And they said, yeah, turn it into a book. So Entrepreneur Revolution came out. Yeah,
it's brilliant. The big kind of discussion point at the start of that is around these times are changing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe we're in a time that's a good time to be an entrepreneur?
It's the best time to be an entrepreneur. It's the most incredible time to be an entrepreneur. And it's an incredible moment for change. 2024. So everything that's happened in the last 20 years has led towards the idea that any one individual can do business anywhere in the world with, you know, they can launch a product that anyone can buy. They can build a brand that anyone can see. The barriers to entry are so low. You can have a global team, a global audience, a global product ecosystem. So all of those things are now easier than ever before. There's more money than ever before on the planet. There's more investors. Everyone's organized into groups. The megaphone of media is available to everyone. So all of those
distribution, as you said,
yeah. Exactly. So those things make it incredible. The big turning point at the moment is AI. So AI is going to change everything. It's a game changing general purpose technology that really does shift the game. Every single industry will be disrupted by AI. Every product, every service, every job in the economy has to shift and mold around where it fits with AI. So, you know, in times of great disruption, entrepreneurs get to thrive because we're the ones who come up with the new ways, the new models.
Yeah, exactly that. And as part of your story, when I've learned more about you, Daniel, you spoke about a fire at your parents' house that led to you selling things at a garage sale for the first time. And you mentioned those garage sales earlier on that became three or four different garage sales as well. So from literally the ashes came something positive. And so in this period of disruption where there will be job losses or redistribution of wealth, all these kind of different challenging paradigms, there's obviously still the opportunity for people to succeed.
Yeah, everything creates new opportunities. Every time something like this happens, it creates new opportunities. Technology actually destroys jobs but creates opportunities. So, for example, Amazon destroyed a lot of people's jobs who worked in bookshops, but it created opportunities to become authors. Uber destroyed a lot of people who worked as a chauffeur or worked in a taxi, but it created an opportunity for anyone who wants to, you know, just go out at night and make some money. So technology tends to do this thing where it destroys traditional jobs and creates opportunities. It's not necessarily a good thing, but it is what happens.
It's the nature, and I would say the genie's out the bottle when it comes to that. Pandora's box is open. Yeah, I think when you think about AI, it was a couple of years ago now, before it was as much of a buzzword, but I hosted a gentleman called Eric Daimler, who was on the Obama administration, and he was head of AI. And I was asking him all these questions. And at the time, the podcast performed relatively well. But when AI became more of a common term, I saw the plays spiking, and I was like, people must just be searching for it. And they found an expert that I've had an hour and a half conversation with. But Eric was, understandably, because he's been at the forefront, pretty defensive of any negative effects that AI could have, because he was like, it will take with one hand, as you were saying, but it will give more with the other. We're yet to ascertain if that's 100% the case, but I found it fascinating that even people who are like massive proponents of AI, and they talk about Pandora's box being open or the genie being out of the bottle, they still understand there's an element of take.
Well, the founder of DeepMind just put out a book called The Coming Wave, where he's very negative about the effects, probably overly negative. It's actually one of these situations where we can't see around the corner. So the issue that we have is that if it was the 1700s and you and I owned a farm and we had hundreds of people who plow the field, and we've always had hundreds of people who plow the field, and there's never been another way to plow the field, it's always just 100 people. And then a steam tractor comes along and two or three people can plow the field in a day. And it's like, what? It used to take 100 people a month, you know. So we would sit there and say, well, what comes next? What's everyone going to do? And it would be impossible for someone in the agricultural age to imagine an industrial age society. So the thing we have to acknowledge is that everyone who's grown up in the industrial age has a mindset of what the world should look like or does look like. And everything's about to change. The steam tractor has just arrived, and we can do the things that took tens of thousands of people to do, and were very, very expensive, are now free and everywhere and all at once.
Yeah, it's fascinating. But you're particularly bullish on it being a good time to be an entrepreneur. As you said, this technology will actually expand upon opportunities that are there. Many of the listeners are like myself and have been either relatively successful in the corporate world and relatively fulfilled, or are maybe on the edge of not being as fulfilled in the corporate world and looking for a way out as well. How can they perhaps assess whether it's right for them to become an entrepreneur?
Well, the first thing I would say is be very careful that the grass always looks greener. There are plenty of entrepreneurs who look at a stable corporate job and go, that would be very nice. I've seen people ruin their whole life by going after entrepreneurship. It's very, very unlikely that a corporate career has prepared you at all for what it's like to start a business. You know, you go to your phone and dial for the IT department to come and fix your IT. They're not coming. You know, you've got no budgets, you've got no brand, you've got no salespeople, you've got no momentum. You are starting with a blank piece of paper, and it's terrifying if you're a corporate. And especially if you happen to have one of the jobs that is secure and you can easily go to the bank and get a mortgage and buy a house and all those things, don't take that for granted, right? So you might look at the very small number of successful entrepreneurs and think it's all like that. For every person like me, there's thousands of people who have tried it and it hasn't worked.
By your very nature, you're an outlier by being on a podcast talking about entrepreneurship.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's amplified because it's more interesting to hear this story.
I never had a corporate career. I've only ever known starting with a blank page. I'm personality-wise, I'm built for it. And I struggle in corporate environments. So there's something about how I'm wired that makes me well suited to this and that basically made me repel away from any corporate structures. So keep that in mind, right? Let's be a little bit sober when it comes to the realities of entrepreneurship, that it's going to slap you in the face. It's going to be a big shift if you'd go down that path. Keep in mind as well that it's very entrepreneurial to scale a business. Maybe leaving a massive corporate and going and joining a team that's doing 3 or 4 million and they want to get to 30 or 40 million and you can take income and equity. So you take a half your income, but you take the other half in equity and you're taking some risk, but actually most of the wealth in business is created in the scale up journey, not in the startup journey, right? So, you know, it only becomes viable if it scales. So, you know, why not jump onto something that's already halfway through the marathon?
A relatively proven concept and you be part of the next phase, which is where the riches maybe lie?
Yeah, and in many cases, a business that has gone through a startup phase, they're ready for someone who they will call a grown-up.
Okay.
So someone who's come out of corporate and who's got corporate experience and knows how things are done properly.
Maybe has some element of the polish, which is positive, but without some of the constraints that maybe people who are forever stuck within a maybe menial corporate role have.
Yeah. So like if you've got 3 million of revenue and someone leaves KPMG to come and work with you, it's like, whoa, this is amazing. This is incredible. Right. So that's probably a good idea. Now, if you are actually hell bent on starting a business, God, I really don't recommend it for anyone in corporate. I really don't. Because here's the other thing. If you have some cool idea, slap yourself immediately. So, like if it's a fashion brand, if it's cookies or cakes or cupcakes, if it's something super creative and lovely and, you know, like, and if it's a million miles from what you know, like just slap yourself. You're just a dreamer, right? This is just stupid. I'm horrible for saying this. You know, the people who do really well, they do stuff that they know. They've got, you know, they've been up to their elbows in it.
Something transferable, as you spoke about earlier.
Yeah. So like, for example, if you get someone whose job at KPMG was doing M&A transactions, they go off and start a small private equity shop doing M&A, fine, right? Fantastic. If you've got 15 years experience and now it's time to do it on your own, great. But please don't do cupcakes, consumer tech, fashion. Like these are all ruthlessly difficult businesses.
And yes, there's some unicorns there, but the vast majority struggle.
Anything that's cool, anything that sounds cool when you tell someone is ruthlessly competitive. So if you're saying, oh, I've got this new fashion brand, leather jackets, blah, 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 blah. It's, you know, this is going to be highly contested. I can't tell you how many new cupcakes are coming out, right?
It's so like, if you were to give people a reality check, but also arm them with tools to support them and maybe judging or analyzing if they were to do this or whether it would even be feasible, what would those be?
This is good. And thank you for getting me off my high horse. There's four tools that test whether your idea is good. First of all, actually, let me just start with a concept. There are distribution curves, right? There's the very famous one is called a bell curve. And that's called a standard distribution. And then there's something called a power law, which is the 80-20 principle. So there are some businesses or careers that are on a bell curve and some that are on a power law. So what do I mean by that? If you're an accountant or a doctor or a dentist, you're on a standard distribution. So you're probably going to earn something like 80 to 180,000. But the gap between the bottom and the top it's probably about 100,000 and most people fit within that bell curve. There's very few people who are off the bell curve. In the world of entrepreneurship, it's a power law. There's Elon Musk with multiple multi-hundred billion dollar companies, you know, and then there's all the billionaires. And then there's the people who have literally lost their entire life savings as a result of starting a business. So that's a massive variant. when you are on a bell curve, the strategy for winning is about investing heavily to become more successful. So if you're a dentist, you keep getting qualifications, you work hard,
new practices,
you overly invest in order to become successful. The strategy for a power law is that you have to fail fast and cheap so that you can afford multiple attempts and iterate really quickly so that you can be the one.
Rude term, you shit test it. And yeah. If it fails, move on.
The goal is to assume that I'm probably on the long tail and I'm not on the uptick. So it's like I'm going to throw a lot of darts at the board so that I can find the one that hits the uptick. So this is very counterintuitive for corporate people. So corporate people don't want to fail. They don't want to look bad. They don't want to do something that doesn't work. They want to protect reputation. They're playing a bell curve strategy. And the bell curve strategy is not the strategy for the entrepreneur strategy, the power law strategy. So the first thing you have to do is find ways to fail fast and cheap. So there's four ways to test whether your idea works and it fails fast and cheap. So the first one is launching a waiting list. So this is where you don't quit your job, you don't invest in any money into anything.
Samples or prototypes.
No, you literally just create a waiting list. And the waiting list says, I'm going to be launching such and such. And if you're interested in that, join the waiting list. And to join the waiting list, it's name, email, and then answer 5 questions about things like price and problems and goals, right? So you just basically put all of that on the waiting list and you launch it. And you cold DM people. You send a message to people and say, hey, I'm launching next year. I'm going to be launching this business. If you're interested, fill in the form and I'll send you the information as it becomes available. And you're just launching a waiting list. And you're not talking to suppliers, nothing. You're just seeing who fills it in. At the very, very basic level, you should assume that a small percentage of people who join the waiting list will actually buy. So maybe if you can get 100 people on a waiting list, you might get 3 to 15 people actually buy something.
That's actually reflective of the waiting list that I launched for my podcast masterclass.
There you go.
So I built a course out for how to start, scale, and sustain a podcast. And I think I've probably got 85 to 90 names on it, just listeners that DM'd me the word master. I just said a call to action at the start of the podcast. I said, if you guys are interested in starting your own podcast, I think podcasts are the growing medium.
Yep.
DM me the word masterclass and either LinkedIn or Instagram and I'll add you. And I think something like 8 people signed up after the first round of emails that I launched. So that's 10%.
1 in 10. Yeah, perfect. So that tells you a lot straight away. Let's just work on 1 in 10. So let's say you're a corporate employee and you launch something and people say, I'm willing to pay $39 for it. And you get 1,000 people on your waiting list after a huge amount of effort. Well, okay, maybe you've got 3,900. That's not even 1 month's worth of wages. So what are you going to do for the other 11 months? Now you can extrapolate. How hard was it to build that waiting list? Are these people going to buy every month or is it a one-off purchase? Right. So all of these things, you're now working with some data.
You can be so much more realistic rather than the dreamer that you were talking about.
Yeah.
I think people would appreciate that as well, because the last thing you want to do is jump off a cliff and just...
And hope.
Try and build wings on the way down. I know there's elements of that's glamorous.
Yeah, there's elements of that and it's glamorized, but it doesn't feel glamorous when you're doing it. It feels terrifying. And it feels terrifying when you've done it 10 times before. So the idea here is that... you also want to identify what the price is, because a lot of times you might think, oh yeah, people will pay $20 for this, and they won't. They'll pay 10 and they'll tell you. Or you might say people will pay $20 for this and they tell you 100. So you want to find out what it is. You want to find out whether it's recurring revenue or one-off revenue, because the only businesses that succeed long-term are recurring revenue businesses. You can't keep going on making one-off sales. You have to have recurring revenue streams and channels. So all of that comes from the waiting list. The next type of test is called an event, right? A Zoom event. You just literally host a Zoom event. You see if you can get 50 people and you present an intro, like I started doing, right? And you literally just take people through all the lay of the land that they need to know. So let's say you're going to be a fitness trainer. So an introduction to getting fit. And you just take people through, these are the misconceptions, this is the reality, here's how it works, here's what a program would look like. And then at the end, you say, if you're interested in being one of my clients, let me know and I'll talk to you one-to-one. So you run an introduction event. The third one would be a scorecard or an assessment. This is a quiz, an online assessment, and people can self-assess whether they need something. So should you start a podcast? Answer 15 questions to find out. All right. So a simple online assessment. Are you suitable for being a podcast host? So that's really powerful. People love filling those in.
Well, we were talking about personality tests, weren't we? They're some of the most popular things on the internet.
So how I came up with ScoreApp was I set up a test called Are You a Key Person of Influence in Your Industry? 90,000 people filled it in, and we made tens of millions off the back of it. So these things really, really work.
And then the data you gather from the scorecard as well, just to go a little bit deeper on that, yeah. Daniel.
Oh, so with the scorecard, it's between 10 and 40 questions that people have to answer to get their score. So that is all information that you know about someone. So let's say you're starting a business helping executives to run their first triathlon. You run a scorecard called Are You Ready to Run Your First Triathlon? An executive, we specialize in working with executives to run a triathlon. We've identified 15 triggers that you should have in place in order to be ready. Answer the questions and find out. So then people go through and answer all the questions. Do you have time? Do you have equipment? Do you have a training partner? Do you have this? Do you have that? So you go and answer all that. And then when they get the score, they now know, oh, wait a second, I'm only 30% ready. There's a 70% gap. So then they know, oh, I want to hire you to help me close that gap. So it works really, really well from a sales perspective. These are the best lead generators. So much data identifies the pain or the weakness straight away. It's no different to a doctor being able to show you an x-ray of your arm is broken, here's where it's broken, and here's what we need to do about it. You're not going to argue with that.
I love that analogy. Yeah, it really brings it to life. Like you say, that here's the pain point, here's what needs to be worked on.
Yeah, and you told me. Like, I didn't tell you. You filled in the questions.
Of course, because there's a lot of, like, if you were lecturing somebody down the microphone or down a video, it's telling.
If I said to someone, you're only 30% ready to run a marathon, they're going to go, well, I'm pretty fit.
Who do you think you are?
Yeah. But if I say answer these questions, oh, the way you answered the question says you're only 30%, then people immediately, well, I filled it in. And then the fourth one is a discussion group. So a discussion group is where you just launch a WhatsApp group and you invite people to join the discussion. So let's say, your plan is to do a consultancy and you're going to consult people on sales training. We're running a sales performance discussion group on WhatsApp. Here's the link, join the discussion. Now, if you can get 400 people who join the discussion, rock and roll.
Yeah, I love that. And I think all four of those are more possible if you do some of the other boxes that you need to tick, which is building yourself as a key person of influence as well. So I love how there's so much synergy between the lessons that you're sharing, Daniel.
You can also bring in a key person of influence. So you can pay someone $1,500 a month to be part of the discussion group. You can pay someone $1,500 to be the person who presents at the event.
Yeah, fantastic point. I'm seeing a lot of e-commerce businesses partner with creators to build out products and services online as well. So almost like, I don't know if you saw the launch of Newtonic, which is James Smith and Chris Williamson's energy, focus drink.
Yeah.
They partner with a guy called Shan Harif who built out the product for them because these guys are the creators, the ideas. They had passion about what was going to go in the drink and what it should do.
Yeah.
But he knew distribution. He knew production. Yeah. He knew operations.
You don't want to underestimate getting the right face for the business. Changes everything. As soon as you've got that right person, everything, all the doors open.
In terms of like having that right face, that personality, that profile, I went deep on your Twitter in preparation for today, Daniel, and I pulled some of the things that I found really interesting. And one of the things that you said recently was that most entrepreneurs could massively improve their marketing if they were able to understand more empathetically their customer and why they buy. Mm. What are entrepreneurs getting wrong in that regard?
What they're getting wrong is they're imagining that the customer has time to think, has clarity about what they want, understands your product or your industry much more than they do. To have proper empathy, you actually have to assume they're busy, they lack clarity, and they're skeptical. Right? So when you go and look at your own marketing, you've got to kind of put on these glasses that say, I'm skeptical of this. Why should I trust this? Where's the names that I've heard of? Where's the customer testimonials? Where's the guarantees? If none of those things are present, I'm worried. I lack clarity. What is this? Why is it of value? What does it help me to achieve that I can't do on my own? All right. So all of those types of questions are the questions that naturally come up for customers. So if you can get into the customer's shoes and see the business through that lens of I'm not clear, I'm skeptical, I'm busy, make it easy, make it fast, and make it trustworthy, then you immediately improve everything.
It makes me laugh. So many corporates have the headline of like, think customer or like, be client focused, but do they actually understand what that means and distill it down in the way you have there, where you're saying, put yourself in their shoes, understand that they're time poor,
they need skeptical and have no clarity.
Do you know, one of the most common phrases I use in my communications is reassure. To reassure you, this, this is what will happen after this happens. For reassurance, this is the process. Because you're using language to overcome that barrier of uncertainty, clarity of what comes next. Because when I make a buying decision myself, one of my number one like filters for it is it going to be fulfilled in the way that I expect it to be?
Yeah.
I need to be reassured that that's the case. So you kind of switch that to when you're communicating to.
Yeah, absolutely. Going through and buying things is a really great way to empathize with the customer. So like for me, when I, like a few years ago, I remember I bought I wanted to get an electric guitar, and I played guitar a lot as a teenager, and I'd always wanted to have a Stratocaster. So I kind of had to get back into understanding guitars and what's important and all of those sorts of things. So going through that process of like shopping and buying and talking to a few people and trying to figure out, do I want a Gibson? Do I want a Stratocaster? You know, all that sort of stuff. It actually, it's one of the great ways to get the empathy of what it feels like to buy something and to go through that whole sales process and all of those sorts of things.
Put yourself back in those shoes.
Yeah, exactly. Also, when I bought a Rolex, you know, going through the process of going on the waiting list and, you know, picking out which one I might want and then being told, okay, it's come in, it's available. Do you want to come down and get it? And if you can't get it in the next 3 days, we've got to sell it to someone else. Oh, okay, I want to go get it.
That's funny because you're talking about sales experience there. Rolex are quite well known for not having a particularly good sales experience because you are treated like hurry.
But that's the magic of it. It's very orchestrated because everyone has the same experience. So they're doing it deliberately globally.
Yeah, exactly that. No, I love it. And the only other tweet that I pulled out of yours that I really want to ask you about is your favorite sayings for staying sane in a crazy complex world. And I think when you're talking about the environment of AI, you're talking about the uncertainty of entrepreneurship and the kind of the madness that you can enter into.
Wars, political left and right debates.
The culture war is massive at the moment. It really is.
All of that, yeah.
Yeah. And I look to you as somebody that has been resolute throughout lots of different experiences, because if you look at your business career, you've gone through, you mentioned the 2008, 2009 financial crash. Yeah. You've obviously gone through the C19 period and probably many other things from a personal perspective.
We actually also have really broad appeal. So I get invited onto podcasts where they've had Andrew Tate as their guest. And I also get invited onto podcasts that are very left-leaning. So we've stayed pretty neutral in the cultural wars as well, even though having strong opinions while also not stepping on any random landmines.
One of the big things about people that have strong opinions but communicate them from an empathetic perspective is that a lot of people have much more respect for it. So there's been times in the podcast where I've made my stance on particular cultural issues relatively clear, but with complete understanding that somebody else might have a totally different perspective from me based on their upbringing, their socialization.
Yeah.
Like what their fiscal state of play is. And I can be like, well, completely understand that. In the same way, I recently had an interview where we talked a lot about faith, and I'm not a particularly religious person and my family aren't particularly religious, albeit I went to Sunday school when I was a little boy because culturally that was the thing to do. I was christened a Protestant in the Church of Scotland, but I'm not somebody that has a practice of it. But over the course of the last 3 or 4 years of the podcast, I've been completely open-minded to somebody talking about their faith. One of the people that spoke most well about it was Simon Thomas. Do you remember him from Blue Peter, Sky Sports? His wife passed away. It was his first wife passed away really, really tragically of cancer within like a week or two of her diagnosis. And I was asking him what role his faith played within that. And he was like, like it was so powerful for me to understand that, but it allows me to have complete perspective that I don't know how I would deal with a situation like that. I wouldn't lean on faith, but he did.
Do you know, the other thing too is people change, or you'll be shocked at some of your views changing over time. So for example, I used to really geek out on, speaking of faith, right? I used to really, really geek out on atheist videos. I loved Christopher Hitchens and all these kind of famous, Dawkins and these famous atheists. I used to watch these debates and really love watching Sam Harris dismantle someone of faith and make them seem foolish and pull the rug.
A little bit utopian.
Yeah, and pull the rug from under them and all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, you become a father and you start to see the world through a different lens, and you have some loved ones who pass away, and you recognize that there's this whole side of the human experience that doesn't really, it's very hard to make sense of certain things through the lens of logic and reason and all this sort of stuff. And actually, stories and traditions and you know, metaphors, and also just trust, you know, faith, actually is a valuable asset for a lot of people. And, you know, suddenly you say, oh, wait a second, there's a lot of value to this that I just discounted and threw away. And there's also, if you believe in, I know we're going off a tangent, right? But if you believe in natural selection and things like that, there are stories that have had a process of natural selection and they've lasted thousands of years. And there's a reason that we've hung on to those stories, and there's something about them that still resonates
over and over and over again. Yeah. And they're able to teach lessons on that are value, whether it's wrapped in a religious context or a faith context.
We've got a left and a right brain, and the left loves logic and the right loves emotion. When you're a salesperson, if you don't sell to the left and the right brain, you won't get a sale, right? So you can present the spreadsheet, people won't buy, even though the spreadsheet says they should. They have to like you and trust you and buy into the story as well as the spreadsheet. So, you know, when it comes to things like, you know, understanding people, you've got to understand people through the lens of the left and the right brain.
Yeah, exactly. And the position they've come from as well. And the sayings that I wrote down and really took on board were, one of them was, not my circus, not my monkeys. What do you mean by that?
Not my circus, not my monkeys means I don't have to get involved in every diabolical, you know, thing that unfolds, right? So you can look at something that is a big upset in the world and you can say, wait a second, this is not my circus, these are not my monkeys, right? So, you know, this particular fight, this debate, this political thing, this cultural thing, you can say, this is just not for me. This
you're allowed to not have an opinion as well, which again, interestingly, as a key person of influence, many people extrapolate out their influence in one field to try and lecture on many, many others.
Yeah.
And they often get made to look foolish when they come up against somebody that is coherent and well-versed.
Yeah, and a lot of these hot topics, they're nuanced. They're incredibly nuanced. And if you don't understand that, you know, you're going to get, you get sucked into it. You're far better off saying, this is not my circus and these are not my monkeys.
Yeah, you stay out of the craziness. The second one that I wrote down was, the pendulum always swings back.
Yeah, so that relates to this idea we were just talking about, that some things that you form a hard opinion on, you swing back the other way. Sometimes society, you see something that you don't like in society, it's often the case that just give it a year and it'll swing back.
It needs to go too far for it to often it come goes, back, and not to get on a soapbox about anything else, but many people are concerned about where access to women's sports has gone with the trans movement. And many people recognize within this niche that trans people have been oppressed for a long period of time, and of course they should have the right to transition and be supported, whatever. But if a female is getting into a swimming pool against a biological male who's had testosterone of an advantage over a number of years, most people disagree with that as well. So we've gone a little bit too far, and now people are pushing back because general population, and the layman isn't always correct, of course, but their opinion is probably quite fair if they've just been exposed to it for the first time. Like, what's your immediate reaction to that? That doesn't sound fair to me. Okay, well, it probably isn't. So we should probably try and understand how we can, as a modern society, adjust this a little bit. So the pendulum does swing back.
The pendulum does swing back. And we have to explore some terrain that's not the right thing. We have to get it wrong in order to get it right. So there's going to be times where, like, for example, with the trans issue, there are going to be decisions where we have to say, okay, let's try this. Okay, that wasn't the right way to approach it. Like, for, you know, the extreme examples of where do you put someone in prison and those kind of questions. So I think it's good to have empathy on both sides, that if you've got strong opinions on either side, just say, hey, we're still figuring this out. We've got to find a solution that works for as many people as possible. We're going to try some stuff that's not going to work. While we've all got the intent of everyone getting along, everyone's got positive intent. So let's just assume that about each other. And, you know, we're going to throw some mud at the wall. Some will stick, some won't stick. And hopefully we find the right answer. But the pendulum always swings back. So this is a good way to not get engaged in everything as well, right? So this is another Stoic principle of, you don't have to get involved in everything. So you can just look at something that's a bit odd and go, I don't agree with that. But you know what? The pendulum always swings back. It's not going to stay that way forever.
It keeps you calmer. And the last but certainly no means least was the truth is the only truth is the result.
So the only truth is the result is you can have strong opinions on things, but ultimately there is things that work and things that don't work. And sometimes, I'll tell you, when it comes to success, there are things that sound really smart and they don't work. And there are things that sound cheesy and naff and stupid or fringe, and they totally work every time. And like, for example, launching a waiting list rather than launching a product. Most people say, in order to start a business, I have to have 1,000 units of something and talk to suppliers and set up a website and have all these things and got to set up a company. Like, I have to have a company structure. I have to have all these things. It's like, no, just start a waiting list. Like, literally just launch a waiting list. Even though that sounds silly to someone who's never done it before, it's the best way to start a business. And the only truth is the result is if people join the waiting list, you're in business. And if you have everything technically correct, but people don't join that waiting list, you're not.
Yeah, Daniel, I love all the wisdom that you shared today. I know we were both feeling the effects of a little bit of jet lag, but we're caffeinated, we're flying. I think the audience have got tremendous value. If they want to continue the conversation with you, where should they head towards?
So I'm on all the social media platforms. My best ideas I put into books. So, you know, when I've consistently said something over and over, I tend to put it into a book. Your audience probably likes Scorecard Marketing. It's one of my latest books. The front half is why people buy. It's all about buying psychology. And the back half is how to implement that into a scorecard marketing campaign. And I think if you like the philosophy of sales, front half, if you want to put that into a tactical implementation, back half of the book. And it's a really short book. It's 20,000 words. So I kept it super short, super punchy, because people have shorter attention spans. They want fast things.
And people fly through it as well. So I will link the link to your books in the show notes, and I'll link to your LinkedIn and anywhere else people want to get in touch with you as well. Nice. But thank you so much, Daniel. And thank you to you, the listener. I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very soon.